Support for Living on Earth comes from listeners like you. Please make a donation online at loe.org or call me, Bobby Bascom, at 617-629-3638. And thanks.
Joining me now is David Corton. He's author of The Great Turning, From Empire to Earth Community. And you also wrote a book called When Corporations Rule the World. Tell me, what happens to the people in the earth when corporations rule the world?
Well, we're talking here about publicly traded limited liability corporations. That's the issue. And this is a corporate form that was basically created in 1600 with the chartering of the British East India Company as an institution to go out and colonize, exploit the resources of colonized territories to benefit wealthy investors and to serve the interests of the king. What we need to realize is that that is very much what even our contemporary corporations are about. They are institutions for concentrating wealth and power with virtually without limit in order to exploit the resources, markets, and people of the world to generate maximum profits for their wealthiest shareholders.
We don't have kings these days, though, at least in the United States.
Well, it's very interesting. If you look at the trajectory, in a sense, we've been in a mode of what I call empire. That's the theme of the Great Turning book for some 5,000 years. And that's basically a society. It's organized around a few people at the top and most people at the bottom. And so we've really essentially morphed from the monarchy as the key institution of elite power and rule to the large global corporation.
In recent years, more and more environmentalists have been advocating market solutions to our environmental problems. What are your views on these types of arrangements?
Well, basically, you know, if you can give the big corporations enough subsidies so it's worth their while to move ahead with environmental technologies, they will respond. But that is going to be normally at an enormous cost to taxpayers. And the thing that's often not mentioned is if you're increasing the profits of corporations, you're basically serving the interests of the wealthiest investors over the working people who actually produce goods and services. And on a global scale, one of our biggest issues, next to the fact that we're exploiting the Earth's resources faster than the Earth can generate, is the extraordinary and growing inequality between the extremely rich and the extremely poor, with the rich being able in a position to expropriate or whatever is left of Earth's resources while people on the bottom make do with nothing. Now, it's interesting when you talk about market solutions, there's a lot of different interpretations about the market. And so much of the current discussion about market solutions is simply focused on if you can rig the system so that corporations make enough profits either through subsidies or through allowing them to externalize costs, they will solve our problems.
Let me just interrupt you for a moment. What do you mean by externalized costs?
Yeah, passing their costs on to others. Like if a company comes in and cuts down the forest that an indigenous tribe depends on for their livelihood, for their hunting, for their gathering, you know, they pay that price. The company walks off with the forest and leaves nothing behind. You know, one of the most obvious is externalizing costs by dumping toxics into the air or into the water, where we all pay the price, and the corporation saves costs and thus increases its profits. Now, it's an interesting thing about market solutions. You know, when I studied economics, you know, there was a recognition that markets needed rules to require the internalization of costs. I also learned that the whole concept of a market based on competition is that one of the first things you need to avoid is the development of monopoly power. You don't want corporations that have so much power that they can buy politicians or that they can charge monopoly prices, as, for example, life-saving drugs. You need markets that are comprised of smaller firms. The example that's always given in economics course of the pure, efficient market is one that's comprised of small farmers who go to the market and are selling their produce competitively with other small farmers so that no individual enterprise can control the price or set the market price. And of course, you know, when we start talking about huge global corporations that either individually control major markets and technologies or that act in oligarchic combinations to set prices. You've got a system that is designed to externalize costs and to generate monopoly prices, as well as to control the political system. So when a corporation says, I'll do good if you pay me enough, that's kind of a form of bribery.
In these recent years, we've seen a green version of virtually every product coming out on the market, whether it's a car that gets better mileage, or a cleaner that's less toxic, or a home that has a lower carbon footprint. To what extent can we consume our way to conservation?
Well, basically, moving toward green products is there's an obvious advantage. If we substitute a green product for a toxic or energy inefficient product, that's an advantage. But all of this misses the point of the extraordinary seriousness of our global scale problem and the larger fact that we are consuming Earth resources at a much more rapid rate than what can be regenerated. And this is in the context of extreme inequality. You know, Forbes magazine just came out as last count that there's 1,250 billionaires in the world. Now, if you're a billionaire, you have no problem of resource scarcity. Your issue may be, what model of private jet airplane are you going to buy for your kid who's just moving into their teen years? Whereas the people on the bottom that are operating on less than $1 or $2 a day are trying to figure out how to put enough food in the mouths of their children to keep them alive. This is not efficient. What we absolutely must deal with is reducing our total overall consumption, and particularly our carbon emissions into the air. But at the same time, moving toward a dramatic reallocation of Earth's resources from rich to poor, and also from those uses that are basically destructive to uses which are beneficial in improving people's lives.
Where do you get the political will to make such deep structural changes in society? Redistributing wealth has been a holy grail of social progressives for a long time, and it seems that we're, if anything, going in the opposite direction.
We're definitely moving in the opposite direction. Now, I think this environmental crisis creates an extraordinary moment of opportunity, because we now are in a position where we face the imperative to fundamentally rethink how we live and how we use Earth's resources. And that moves us into these other questions. And one of the things we have to do is get beyond this myth that, as the economy grows, we bring the bottom up. And so we don't need to worry about the people on the top. We will all increase our consumption. And that's a major blind spot in economics, the idea that on a finite planet you can have infinite growth. So it really is a matter of stepping back and rethinking everything. But one of the other pieces that I find so fascinating that we don't talk about is it's often presented that the changes we need to make will involve serious sacrifice. But one of the things I learned in all my experience living around the world and in working with the global citizen movements is that for all the diversity of the world's cultures and peoples, when you get right down to it, most of the world's people want a world in which our children are healthy and happy, in which we have strong families, in which we have strong communities, caring communities, where we care about one another, look out for one another's well-being, and a healthy natural environment. Now, when you're dealing with situations where people are extremely poor, we absolutely do need increases in economic output, but beyond a very basic level, once we begin moving beyond meeting basic human needs, real happiness depends on the strength of our communities and families, basically very foundational conservative values. And what's so extraordinary when you begin to take this apart is to realize that the world we actually need to create, a world without war, a world without long commutes, a world in which we preserve our forests and our agricultural lands and have a healthy natural systems, is basically the world that people envision when they think about the world in which they'd really like to live. So it's actually, we face a combination of the imperative to change as a price of our very survival as a species, combined with the opportunity to create the world that most of us actually dream about, but we're told is beyond our reach.
So to what extent are you optimistic about the future then?
Well, I sometimes, frankly, Steve, get very scared because the rate at which our environmental systems are collapsing is terrifying. And that's permanent. Once these systems collapse, it's very difficult to recover. Now, ironically, one of our best hopes may be the fact that we are moving rapidly into a serious collapse of the financial system. You know, people who ask about whether we're moving into recession are basically living in another world. They're not looking at this larger picture of the combination of the massive financial speculation and extreme instability of our financial system, combined with the fact that this is not a normal business cycle because we are also running up against very real limits. We've got more and more people competing for this diminished resource base, and everything from oil to fresh water to the limits of the climate. And this is not going to be a normal recovery. Now, as harsh and as difficult as a financial collapse will be, it could in some ways be considered a blessing because it forces us to step back and ask some of these deeper questions about what we want and to consider reforms that previously were off the table, very much like what happened with the Great Depression of the 1930s. When we reoriented our national priorities, we broke a lot of the established rules of the economic system, the elitist economic system, and asked a lot more questions about what do we need to do to make this economy actually work for people in society. Unfortunately, we've been forgetting a lot of those lessons and loosening up a lot of the regulations that we put in, particularly on the financial institutions to reduce the financial speculation and resulting instability.
David Corden, what is an Earth community and how do we build one? And how does environmentalism play into that?
Well, I think of it very much within the frame of a healthy ecosystem. You know, first of all, you know, when we talk about the things that people really want, one of the great longings is for a sense of community, a sense of belonging. Now, we normally think about that primarily in terms of a human community. But as we move deeper into our understanding of our human relationship to Earth, Mother Earth, that sustains us, we realize that we have to expand our concept of community, that it's a community of people and nature living together in balance with one another and Earth. And that is the model of a healthy ecosystem. Again, you know, we're so locked into stories that are very partial or even false, including the idea that life is fundamentally competitive and that progress comes through competition. If one steps back and takes a deeper look at living systems, as some of the people at the forefront of the new biology are doing, you begin to recognize that at a deeper level, life is a fundamentally cooperative project, and that healthy ecosystems live in a very dynamic balance in which they optimize together the use of available sunlight and other resources to maximize the vitality of the life of the entire community. And I think that's the mental frame that we need to begin bringing to how we think about the economy, that you know, the economy simply cannot function in a healthy, sustainable way unless we look at it within this larger context.
Earth Day started in 1970. Today, there are a lot more corporations, companies involved in the promotion of this. Does the corporatization of Earth Day in the United States, to you, does this symbol a great awakening among companies, or is this a great sellout?
Well, I think it certainly reflects a change in the public consciousness, an awareness on the part of corporations that they had better appear green, or they're going to lose a lot of consumer loyalty. I think it also reflects the fact that there are many people in corporations who are as deeply concerned about the environment as any of us are. The unfortunate reality, however, is that the institution itself is legally structured in a way that it is very difficult for it to make any choices that do not increase its profits. And the excesses of corporate profits from the externalization of costs and from the exercise of monopoly power is a major part of the problem, not only in terms of environmental destruction, but also in terms of growing inequality.
David Corton's latest book is called Great Turning from Empire to Earth Community. Thank you so much for taking this time.
It's been a great pleasure, Steve.